Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next, a dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
Welcome to a special episode of What's Next. I'm host Thomas O'Neill White, and this is our back-to-school roundtable discussion for the 2024-2025 school year. Joining me today is Jessica Bauer-Walker, president of Buffalo Public Schools Community Health Worker Parent and Student Organization, Danielle Grismala, co-chair of the Buffalo Parent Teacher Organization, Ed Spidell, president of the District Parent Coordinating Council, and all three are members of the BPS Parent Congress. Now, Ed is running for the Board of Education this year, but he is here in his capacity as president of the District Parent Coordinating Council. We are also joined by two BPS students, Rahema Kishindi and Shannon Morgan. Welcome, Shannon, and to the rest of the group. Thank you for coming back on with us for this important discussion.
So, Jessica, I wanted to circle back to a conversation we had in June. We discussed the possibility for a roundtable at the end of the school year, but your team was feeling pretty exhausted from the school year. Just generally speaking, what had you feeling so beaten down at the end of the school year?
Well, I think that this work is hard. I actually just heard a story last week talking about parental stress being so high and that the Surgeon General actually talked about it as a public health issue at this point, which was quite validating for us as parents. It's difficult parenting in these times, and especially teenagers. I think that the work is really difficult. We're not unique in Buffalo Public Schools in terms of dealing with some of the challenges in public education. We've had some additional challenges in the Buffalo community and just deal with all of the community dynamics that we have in this city. So I think just fighting for the issues that we've been fighting for, dealing with the stuff in our own personal lives, we're really focused on working with the most vulnerable students. And so we just see a lot of issues, and dealing with them day in and day out for your own children and other children by the end of the school year can be pretty exhausting.
Danielle, are you on that same page?
Yeah, it's hard out here, right? Working in Buffalo Public Schools with all the kids and all the different issues, it was a lot. You know, we worked together to try and make some progress, but just doing the work and showing up and going to meetings and expressing your opinions and what you think and feel, and then having to come home and parent and just do the regular everyday stuff. By the end of the school year, you're exhausted. It was a rough end of the year. Some of it was well needed.
I find the same challenges. I had two sons still in school. One was medical home instruction with anxiety, and John, little Johnny, with autism. So not only have that at home, but then helping the families in the district and treating them like their children are my children, fighting for them the same way that I would fight for my own sons or daughters, so that they could get the whatever they needed, whether it was going to the right class, whether it was not being suspended longer, getting an aid in their class, the right school bus, just fighting for them as if they were my own child.
And we're going to be talking about a lot of these issues this episode. Abraham, I want to get to you as a student. You know, how are you feeling at the end of last school year?
I mean, besides it being like the end of my junior year, which was already pretty intense, it was just like so much going on. Like, I remember, like, we went to Board of Education meetings. We were dealing with a lot of things with the district, just as a organization. So it was like a lot of things that we were trying to speak out against and, you know, like, advocate for, because, like, you know, a lot of things come up, and it was just like, it felt repetitive and, you know, just kept going at it, and It was hard.
Coming before the school board, do you feel like your voice was heard? Do you feel like the board respected you as an individual and as a student?
I can definitely see the intention was there and there was room and, you know, space made for me, which was, you know, beyond grateful for. However, there was many instances where it felt like I would go to Board of Education meetings and speak, and I wouldn't see any like hard, you know, evidence of these things. Like, I'm extremely appreciative of everything that was, you know, given to me and the opportunity and the space, and also like the acknowledgement, because a lot of times it's hard to acknowledge, you know, like all the small people in a big district. So I appreciate it, although there was a few hiccups where I felt like I just kept talking about the same things and it just wasn't coming to a conclusion.
And Shannon, you are new here in this newsroom as part of this discussion. You are going into your junior year. Did you feel as tired? Did you feel as beaten down this past school year as everyone else?
Well, I did, but like, as it's like, as far as like the test, like the region, stuff like that, that's what made me a bit tired. I just had to like, you know, stay on that and kind of like study for it so I can like do good in junior year, like so it wouldn't be as hard. But that's pretty much it.
Superintendent Tanja Williams Knight recently gave her a State of the Buffalo Public Schools address, and she mentioned the 5x2025 community inspired strategic plan. That 5-point plan is, you know, eliminating opportunity gaps for students, ensuring all children have access to educational excellence every day in school, prioritizing safety and security every day on every campus, amplifying all voices, cultivating trust with the community, and activating new partnerships. In a broad sense, these are things that parent groups have been calling for a long time. Are those reassuring words coming from the superintendent?
I mean, she's saying the right words and it's written down the way we want it. Like, that's what our end goal is. But I don't think the message is getting to everybody. And I don't think every school or every teacher, maybe even some families, are living this. And I think that we have a huge gap when it comes to our children of color and our children with disabilities, that we're still, there's so much work to be done. I mean, that's what I do almost every day. I get a phone call from another family with a child with disabilities that's not getting the services or not in the right school. So we have a lot of work to be done. I think the statements are great, but mm-hmm. the progress isn't as good as it should be.
Danielle, how you feel about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, when you read the 5x25, that's exactly what we ask for, right? This is what we're fighting for and what we have been fighting for. So I appreciate that the superintendent went on her listening tour and that she's taking the things that we say as community seriously and putting them into her plan. What we see when we deal with this work on a daily basis, we see the inequities. So like, hearing that we want to eliminate gaps and we want to have equity, yeah, you're saying all the right things, and we want that. That needs to be done. We've got a lot of work to do to get there.
Yeah, I think, again, this is a good high-level framework. The superintendent and many of the board members have been doing this for some time. I know that they used a different approach with, you know, very specific, measurable SMART goals and indicators, and they met some of those goals. We're nowhere near where we need to be in terms of things like opportunity gaps. The, you know, you look at our children and where they're at reading and writing on grade level, and mm-hmm. yes, there's been some improvements with third graders based on those goals, but way, way below where we should be in terms of those indicators. And again, if you start to break things down by academics, by attendance, by behavior, around race, around socioeconomics, around disabilities, whether a child speaks English as a first language, you see significant, significant gaps. And we've been dealing with so many issues that are just real basic issues. So we see ourselves as parent advocates, and that's why we're really investing in working with our youth and trying to amplify youth voice so that they can speak to their direct experiences. Because even us as parents, we don't know what it's like to be a young person right now.
Right.
The stuff that the teenagers are dealing with in particular, it's not like it was even 5 years ago and not like when we were growing up. And so we really, really need to listen to our young people and understand, you know, when we put these high level frameworks, what does that look like in reality and in practice?
Yeah. What would be like a next step that the district could do where you would say, oh, okay, I think they're on the pathway of doing the right thing, or what they're doing is in line with what we believe?
Yeah, we've talked about a lot of these things. I'd love to turn it over to the students, some of the things that they've been working on. They actually, last year, were working on kind of outlining top issues that they felt were important to them.
To preface, like, I feel like if the district was to just like have a heavier emphasis and an actual tangible ways of integrating the community that would make things 10 times better. Because even like everyone knows that when you have multiple people from different walks of life doing, working on one thing, like you get a truly holistic approach. So there's that. And there's just so much that we've done to be able to like identify the issues and identify solutions. We did a survey last year and we identified five top issues with, I think it was like food and suspension coming up, like some of the top ones. So it was like we've been trying to identify the issues and what issues are more like most important to the people in our, you know, district, and then how do they think we can improve on this. And we've had conversations, we've went out to different schools, and we didn't just use the textbook student, you know, like the best of the best. We used students mm-hmm. from everywhere, students who are challenged, you know, like everything that they're like, that going through multiple things, to be able to join the conversation too, and people who might not have had the chance to talk up, like speak up.
Now, did you just go into the schools and do that? How did you get that survey across?
So fortunately, we were able to go into Hutch Tech during one of the lunch periods and talk, but we also were at Fountain Plaza, and we were making multiple efforts at different locations throughout the city where we knew that students would be like real students, where we can get a good sample size of what they're thinking and what they need.
Yeah, we were going out on the streets. This started because, you know, we were hearing a lot of rhetoric around students fighting, being downtown at Fountain Plaza. Right. And we know that there's underlying issues that cause those types of behaviors. And so we actually started, we went out on Valentine's Day. It was before a Board of Education meeting. We went out with surveys, we brought snacks, and we put the surveys in the hands of the youth. And the youth started to talk to the other youth. Youth want to talk to youth mostly, mm-hmm. right? And so as all these kids are converging downtown, the youth are talking to the other youth. And we've gone outside schools at dismissal. We've gone into schools. We got approval for doing this questionnaire from the district. We had to go through a pretty rigorous process to do that. But, you know, we don't wait for this. Like, we'll work with the district as much as we can. But when we see a need, we're mobilizing with each other. We had partners. We had students. Shannon, maybe you can talk a little bit about what your experience was, because you've been out there, you know.
They was, like, really engaged about what we was talking about. Like, they was like, how can I put it? They wanted to like know more about it, and like when we asked them questions about what was the like main topic, it was mostly a lot of school safety, and they were just telling us about how like the school isn't safe with metal detectors, and transportation was hard. They were just being very understanding about it.
In your experience, what's been school safety issues for you?
Honestly, in my school, I think my school is pretty safe with the, you know, metal detectors and stuff like that. So I can't say nothing about school safety.
Emma? I think personally, I don't think like there has been any like serious issues at the school that I'm at. But unfortunately, we've had heavy like policing in our schools almost, even though there hasn't been like actual police officers in our schools. There has been a lot of security and a lot of like processes that make us feel like what's in the school that's making it so unsafe. There's so much that's like you have to go through the process of getting into the school in the first place, and just feeling like almost like it's criminalizing students. And it's like, what have I done so wrong? I also like, I don't completely understand the process of like teachers not having to go through that same process as students and being checked. It's just kind of confusing. And it's like almost like a false narrative of safety, because like if something was to actually happen, like what does going through my pencil case help?
Right. My next question was, does that actually make you feel safer?
Not really. Like, and that's like, I understand that, like, you know, the intention behind having all this, you know, heavy metal detectors and all this stuff and doing all these checks and ensuring that there's an ample amount of security guards at the schools. I understand the intention behind it, but it doesn't increase the feeling. It actually increases the feeling of unsafety, because it's like, okay, now it's like it's almost scary. Like, it's like, it's overwhelming.
And sometimes I think that there's policies that are put in place with the intention to make things safer, like restrictions on bus passes, for instance. Shannon, do you feel like the restrictions on the bus passes make things safer for you if you need to to and from someplace?
Because some people have, like, I'm not going to say me, but some people can't go, you know, certain places, so they have to, you know, take a different route. But that, it restricts them from doing that, from, like, taking the route they need to take. Sometimes, and it's also like you can get home faster, but like with the restriction on there, they give you a certain route that takes longer to get home. So
why the restrictions?
I honestly don't even know myself.
Right? I personally feel like, I mean, I think I feel like there's ways they're trying to mitigate like fighting and stuff like that. And like, it's understandable to a certain extent, like why they would try and like control where students are going and when and how, you know, all that stuff. But at the end of the day, like it was said in the previous year, if a student wanted to engage in a fight or something, they would pay the $2 to go do that. So it's like, now if I miss my bus and it's like, okay, there's a route, like a 5-minute walk from here that I can take home, I can't even get on that bus. I have to wait the 30 minutes for this next, you know, it's like, It's a big inconvenience that oftentimes isn't like overlooked, because it's like, oh, well, you can't get on that bus because you're going to find a conflict there.
Right. And that's something that the parent groups, BBTO in particular, years ago fought for the routes to be removed from the bus passes. And I think 2 years ago now, the routes just got put back on and it was for safety, which, okay, I get that. But like Rahama just said, kids are going to find a way. Mm-hmm. And I know I said this when we did this last year, I hear more from the parents who are in the same boat. You know, my kid missed the bus. Now they have to wait 30 minutes. We have a 2-hour limit. So if your bus is only coming every 30 minutes, you miss a bus, you could be out of luck because you could miss your window for traveling home. It's also more important for me to have kids be able to take whatever route they feel safest. If they know something's going down and it's going to be at where they normally get off, they should have the ability to just take whatever route gets them home, whatever they need to take to get to their safe place. So
the NFTA has actually overstepped their rights, and the district has allowed them to make a policy that they don't have any business making. And the policy is to benefit adults, not children. Why would we want our children to take longer to get home? We're responsible for them to get home safely. Wouldn't we want them to get home as fast as they could and as safe as they could? So the policy is set up to benefit adults, not children. And that's where the problem starts and finishes. Well, who do we work for? We work for children. The education system is for children, and our adults in our city have lost that.
Is there any evidence that shows that this program has decreased violence, school fights, any of that?
Well, I mean, we had all those restrictions last year, and then according to the news, there was lots of problems at Fountain Plaza. So I think, you know, we've said it before, and we need to come together and talk to people about the underlying issues that are causing these fights and things of that nature.
Additionally, I don't think like I feel like personally the restrictions are creating more problems, because then you have the peacemakers downtown trying to enforce these restrictions that this is their job. They have to enforce these restrictions, and they're creating more conflict because it's like, oh, you know, people catching attitudes because they don't understand. And it's like all these people trying to enforce the restrictions that were placed on them by higher ups. It's just like a never-ending conflict. And
one issue that has gained traction over the last year is the food commissary issue. The one BPS has now, the commissary, is obviously too small to serve the current student body of both the BPS and charter schools. There's been so many starts and stops for this idea of a new food commissary. I do want to shout out Ben Tsujimoto from the Buffalo News for his great reporting on this issue. Where do we stand with the new food commissary? And tell us about going in front of the superintendent and the Board of Education recently, Jessica.
Yeah, this is something that I've been working on for about a decade at this point, because, you know, we live in a food insecure city. So many of the families that I work with, they don't have access to healthy, fresh, affordable food. And so over the years, we've been advocating in large part directed by the students for things like a federal farm to school program and for, you know, getting salad bars or veggie stations in all the schools. Now there's a huge farmers market program. So we've gotten a lot of resources. The food service director, Ruth Connor, and Bridget O'Brien Wood before her did great work securing resources and, you know, really innovative ideas and plans. They've brought in a group called Chef Brigade that works with institutions to help them use fresh produce and source from local farmers and develop healthy, fresh, culturally appropriate foods. And we've done some taste testing. Our students have some feedback about that probably. So we know that this stuff is possible, and we have to have the infrastructure to do it. So it sounds like that over the past couple of years, there's been a lot of mistakes that have happened, quite honestly, and a lot of misunderstanding on the part of the district and the city of Buffalo to make sure that a building could be purchased, and now the situation with the city seems to have fallen apart. So now the district's gone back to saying that they are going to lease a building. I mean, now we're at a point where the last lease is over and they have to do something. We continue to find ourselves in crisis situations. It never had to come to this. And we've just been asking again for accountability, transparency. We need a ample food service building that can provide capacity and provide the type of food that our students need. The students are hungry, and they tell us that. That's been their top issue. It's related to a lot of academics, behavior, a lot of other things. And, you know, we have to figure out how to get this done. But now we're in a situation, without getting into all the nuances and the bureaucracy, where we're looking at investing in a huge investment in a developer instead of public infrastructure and an investment for the future. So I think, you know, we may be at a point where we have to make some hard decisions, and certainly not ideal positions. And this kind of stuff can be avoided if we bring everybody to the table and work together.
And what has been the response from the district about everyone working together?
You know, in the spring, the members of Parent Congress, we all got together and we were like, we need to know what's going on. This was supposed to break ground in September. All of these things, we were very confused about what was going on. And the superintendent and her staff have been willing to meet. They're like, oh, we'll meet with you. But at that point, we were just at a loss. Like, we've met with the district, and at that point it was on the city. So we were like, we want to get everybody, all of us together. And we couldn't really get the city to come to the table. And fast forward to now September, and here we are, right? We will be meeting with the superintendent and her staff to, you know, talk about our options and understand this a little bit further, because we want community input. We need to understand what's going on, and we want to have the best process possible. We want to have the best commissary possible, whether that's a lease or however we have to do it. We need to understand, and we've got to bring the community along. We all know that the commissary needs to get done. It's not a, oh, maybe. Everyone has agreed that it needs to get done. And now we need to see what the best way to move forward is.
I think personally, my biggest thing is not ending up like in 5 or 10 years, not ending up in this same spot. Mm-hmm. It feels like a lot of the things that are being done are just trying to create an illusion that we're moving along, or that we're including people and we're doing this and we're really trying. But it's at the end of the day, if we're gonna push really like hard and fast to do one thing, and then at the end of whatever process we have, end up in the same position, was it really worth it? Especially since, like, now we were provided lunches by the district, and not to, you know, to say the least, it wasn't the most nutritionally fulfilling meal. You know,
real quick, what's the healthiest food item?
Last I remember, we had a bologna sandwich, nectarine, and milk.
Carrots.
We had carrots, and then we also had goldfish. But it's like, it's extremely, like, you can tell it's processed. Like, this could have been avoided if we had a good commissary that was working and was doing all the things they needed to do. Because, shout out to Ruth Connor, she's done an amazing job at explaining to us that having a good commissary that's working and active can create consistency throughout through all the schools. And a lot of people that go to other schools throughout this past year, I've been hearing like, oh, we got a different lunch, or our lunch wasn't as good as your lunch. And it's just like creating this consistency and making an effort to move forward in the most, like, I don't know, in the most thoughtful way, just thinking about every part of it too. It's like, it's extremely important.
And equity as well, right? Shannon, I know food is important to you too. What are some of the things that we know are possible? What are some of the good meals that you've had?
Well, we had went to Casanova Park in South Park, and they had like a food truck, and they had this hamburger. I don't know. It was different from school hamburger, but it was good. But the thing is, it doesn't taste like that in school. I feel like on the food truck, they put more, I would say more love into it, more than, you know.
They're cooking food. Stuff fresh. They're grilling the food. Right. It's not just a packaged, you know, processed USDA type of hamburger. They actually have partnerships with local farmers and getting New York State beef and eggs. And we've had beautiful meals prepared for us with plant-based burgers and a street corn salad with local corn and smoothies and things like that. And the youth love it. And they're eating plant-based food, fruits and vegetables, culture-responsive foods. We've had tacos, we've had rice and beans, we've had a lot of different chana masala, a lot of different meal options.
I remember attending an event where you had the farm fresh stuff.
Right. So we know that that's possible. Our kids will eat that. When we've been getting these processed packaged foods over the summer, which is, you know, better than nothing, but the kids are hungry and we appreciate the food. But at the same time, sometimes they won't eat it. It's not palatable, or they'll have food allergies, or just, you know, the carrots that they're getting, they're not the fresh local carrots, right? They're the prepackaged, you know, yeah. You know, when children are exposed to an apple that doesn't, that's mealy and doesn't taste good, or a hard nectarine, or, you know, prepackaged baby carrots, they don't know that fruits and vegetables can actually really be delicious. It tastes like a completely different food when you have fresh local food. And so we want to make sure that we're doing that and providing as much access as possible. And right now we don't have the capacity to do that.
Ed, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I wanted to add that the commissary is really a problem from the day they started planning it. They don't have the proper people to plan this project. They should have done it from outside source, because they didn't follow the law. They didn't follow the timetable. They didn't seem to do anything correctly. And now we're caught in a situation that either we push for this to get approved, which is a bad lease, or we won't get a new commissary before anyone in this room's children are still in the school district. So the district needs to find a way, when they have these big projects, to actually bring in an expert to plan and develop and do this. And it was dropped in the lap of the current staff. So it's not, no one's at, like, David Hills is responsible for this, but he didn't start this project. Mm-hmm. He's the guy held out to dry right now. Like, Dave, what's going on? How could this work right? 5-6 years ago, when they started this process, they should have hired the proper people.
There was a recent Buffalo News editorial on the commissary and kind of the infighting with the school board. But Jessica, you shot a note to me saying there's a key issue missing from that editorial.
Yeah, I think the piece that we're asking for is just the accountability and transparency of what happened. You know, we appreciate that board member Cindy McCutcheon had put a resolution forth at the last board meeting. Mm-hmm. The Buffalo News editorial board is pushing for the commissary, but we're talking about a lease, right? So this is not going to be a publicly held asset. And we want to know, as citizens, as parents, what happened here? Because all last year we were waiting, asking, going to common council meetings, going to board of education meetings, asking for updates. And it looked like the city and the in Buffalo Public Schools were working together so that the city could purchase the building, which the district is not able to do by state law, which they did not initially realize. And then somehow this deal fell apart, but we still don't know the details about that. And we're responsible to parents and students, and we're taxpayers here. So we want to understand, why is this not going to be public health infrastructure? This is a huge project, and we should have the county, the city, you know, Feedmore, all the entities coming together to work on this, because you see, our youth are saying, we don't want to create a situation, because guess what? This will be coming up again in 10, 15, 20 years when Shannon and Rahema have kids. And so they'll be dealing with this on the parent side all over again. We're not going to do this to our children in the next generation. That's just not fair.
And then they did discuss options outside of leasing the building. So I guess we will see where that goes in the coming year.
We will see.
Suspensions. Obviously, I think I got to know you through your work dealing with suspensions. I kind of want to break this down into two parts. Just talking about the superintendent's claim of a decrease of more than 500 suspensions due in part to restorative practices. But Jessica, you would say these numbers are incorrect and the restorative practices are being used incorrectly?
I wouldn't say that necessarily. I would say that we need to put these numbers in context. So the assertion is that the suspension numbers have gone down based on the district data. They have gone down. The long-term suspensions have not gone down as much as short-term suspensions. We also hear a lot about what we would call informal or honestly illegal suspensions, where students are asked to go home for a day and calm down, or sometimes a couple days. We also know that there's a lot of in-school suspensions, and we have asked for data on that, and we have not been able to get them. And while the students are in school, they're not getting regular classroom learning. The students cannot teach themselves certain subject areas. They're in a room all day long, right? So I'm sure our students could speak to some of the practices that they're seeing, but the numbers have not gone down that significantly. We're still seeing thousands of students suspended. And those disparities, if you look at the data, you know, the disproportionality, what we would call the difference between a white child who is of a higher socioeconomic status, who doesn't have a disability, their chance of getting suspended is so much less likely. And we see this in the research too. And we've done our research around looking at ways to reduce and eliminate suspensions. Other districts that have done that, they see an increase in disproportionality. So while numbers may be going down overall, the number of Black students that are getting suspended, students with disability, low-income students, students who don't speak English as a first language, can actually go up. So back to that equity piece, I think we really need to do a deep dive and say, are we truly doing better? One of the things we've asked for is, what are the total days of suspension? Because a long-term suspension can range anywhere from 6 days to the entire school year, basically. And so I think we just need to do a little bit of digging deeper and just start implementing some real changes around, you know, let's eliminate K-3 suspension. Like, why would a kindergartner be suspended? And I mean, these students can talk about some of their experiences with suspension for themselves and other students around, you know, what they perceive to be district practices. And are we doing restorative practices?
Yeah. Shannon, do you want to speak on that?
Oh, yeah. I got suspended a couple of times, but there's a couple of them where they were unnecessary. I was suspended for being at least less than 5 minutes late to class. And mind you, I just got off of suspension that day. So I came back ready to do my work, and I wasn't late to class, but they told me I was 2 minutes late. I got to class, and they called me to the office, and they had suspended me. They sent me home with a notice letter or something like that. But
So what happened after that?
I think that was a 2-day suspension, so I just did those 2 days and then came back and, you know, just went back to doing my work.
Now, before I get to you, Ed, I want to talk about the restorative practices, because it seems like students, from what I'm hearing, students are getting suspended and then they're doing restorative practices, and that should be kind of the other way around. There should be restorative practices kind of to try to avoid being suspended. Do I have that right?
That has been our experience to some degree. Rahema is actually trained in restorative practices and can speak to this as well.
So even if you think about it, just the word, I think it's thrown around a lot and kind of lost its meaning. But restorative is to restore the harm that's been done.
Right.
And if, you know, principal or administrative staff is taking that immediate response to suspend a student before having a conversation, asking the right questions, because a lot of times these situations and conflicts are very inflammatory. They start really small and just build and build and build and blow up into something that is completely unexpected. So if there's conversations being had, and instead of asking what is wrong with you, asking what happened to you, trying to have that conversation. And of course, this process of working through conflict is extremely difficult, because we're humans with emotions. We have so much more. We're complex. And it takes a lot more time. But for that small, for the 5 minutes that it takes to ask a student a question or to let the student calm down or whatever, just restorative practice as a whole, ensuring that the person is being seen, just for that, that sacrificing that 5 minutes to save someone 3-4 days of suspension, is it worth it? Is that not worth, 5 minutes versus 3 days, 4 or 5 days? You know what I mean? It's it might be a little easier, if we're slowly creating these relationships, because restorative practices builds off of relationship building and connection throughout the school. So if I know that this counselor or whatever is, has my side, has my back, will defend me, and I've just experienced a conflict, maybe having a restorative, circle with someone who's going to support me and advocate for me and be there is going to help me to improve my behavior, to realize maybe, what I can do to move on, and to get the teacher to wait to solution that is going to, make everybody feel good.
So we've had Dina and Debbie on from Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition. We've actually had members of the JFK High School, Middle School on to talk about the unmitigated successes that their school has gone through by applying restorative practices. So I guess my question is not to you guys, but you guys are going to have to answer. It's more to the district. Why are we not doing this? Why are we not implementing this in every single school in the district? Can someone please answer that?
Danielle. I don't know that we can answer that, but I do know, we sit in these meetings and the intention is there, and the district wants these practices implemented, and the staff is being trained. Until we carve out space to actually do the work and have people be committed to actually doing the work, we're not going to get there. You can't just say, okay, tomorrow we're doing everything like this. That is not how it works. They're right. Restorative practices, right? Like, so we need to practice. You can't just go to a training and then be like, oh yeah, no, I'm good. I'm trained and I can take that up. This is hard work and we have to be dedicated and committed to it. And more on the equity piece, there are schools in our district that are doing this beautifully already and have been for years. And for me as a parent, that's not fair. I love that it is available at these schools and it should be, but why does this school or that school get to have these practices that are good for the children and good for community building and other schools don't? Our children go to different schools. So we see the inequity. It's right there on display because I may be having, I have one child, but there are lots of parents that I work with that have multiple kids in multiple buildings and they have vastly different experiences.
Yeah. And the second part of this suspension issue has to do with addressing behavioral and academic needs of special education and English language learner students. Ed, can you shine a little bit more light on that?
Well, when it comes to special ed, the teachers quite don't understand the disabilities. There's not enough training. And I'll say the whole process goes back to they're looking at fixing every school at once. And if you're a business owner, you look at your problem, you go, how do I solve this problem? And educators are failing to, our educators, our district, is failing to look at this problem and breaking it into small pieces they can handle. Why don't we have one or two schools doing this? And why aren't we making that one or two schools experts at the process? And then going to 3 to 4 schools, 5 to 6 schools. So we understand that this is a process, but they don't have a process to make this work over 10 years, 15 years. They're just trying to, hey, principal, don't suspend this, do that. So they're having conversation, want to do it, but they haven't really come up with a plan that says, this year we're going to give the resources to these 3 schools and we're going to support these schools until they do it right. When that's done, we're going to move the resources to new schools. You have to have a business plan. And with educators are so used to black or white, there's only this way or that way. And business people know that you have to have a bigger plan. And we need a bigger plan that will actually address this. And when it comes to special needs and English learners, they just don't have the patience. I found over the years that when I get into a room with the families in the schools, they're all mad. I give them a couple minutes to like yell at each other. And I'm like, are you guys better? Because now what are we going to do to help this student? Their feelings are in the way. A lot of people's parents, our feelings get in the way. The teacher's feelings get in the way. Sometimes the principal's feelings get in the way. So if we broke the system down, instead of us having 60 schools, can we work on 4 schools and make them experts? And once we fix that school, leave that staff intact and move on to the next one. And maybe maybe a set of 500 less suspensions that we'll say isn't really that good. We have 1,000 less suspensions and then 1,200. And then, you know, every year we see a big increase because the schools that we train properly no longer have 400 or 500 suspensions. So it's a lack of planning.
And I think, you know, we have to really have a holistic approach in terms of how we're addressing this. And, yeah. You know, I see the behavioral issues. We, as a public health practitioner, we talk about mental, emotional, and behavioral health. And so when a student is acting out, a lot of these special education students, we see that these are manifestations of their disability, right? We see that there's cultural misunderstandings or language gaps with our English language learners. You know, when the students that we've worked with are suspended, a lot of times it's us going into a meeting and we're helping to facilitate a restorative process and say, well, what's going on? Or do you know what's actually happening with this student? Helping to navigate them through that process. And that's where I think advocacy is really important. And we have been working to really empower our students in particular, our parents and community members too. But the students, one of the top reasons for suspension is insubordination, right? And that's really, again, that's a misunderstanding. That's a failure to communicate. And so how do we build those skills? And sometimes you need an outside entity that can help to facilitate that because that's not the core competency of school districts, right? Mm-hmm. But when the superintendent makes an assertion of we're a restorative district with this volume of suspensions that are going on and some of the tactics that they have around safety and security, I would disagree with that, right? Because we're using a lot of punitive tactics. We're using a lot of policing strategies versus restorative strategies. And so I think we have to just come to the table and just be honest about what is really, and if we have a values conflict in terms of, using punitive approaches or using restorative and a shared understanding of consequences, then we need to talk through that, right? But I think it's almost like a cultural divide. And, you know, learning from JFK and the districts that Erie County Restorative Justice Coalition has worked with, they really talk about a culture shift, right?
Yes,
and a culture of wellness. Mm-hmm. And I think the underlying piece and one of the other issues that we've worked on that's complementary to this is mental health and wellness. And these are pieces that, you know, if a kid is hungry, they're going to act out, right?
Right.
If a kid has unmet needs or they have trauma at home, there's going to be some behavioral issues. And so we really have to, as Rahema was saying, ask what's going on here. And we're here to help. A lot of us are trained as restorative practitioners and community health workers and advocates. And we're training our students to do that too, so that they can advocate for themselves and they have some language around this so they can ask for a restorative conference.
And that's actually the perfect segue to my next question to the students, Rahema and Shannon. You feel that your mental health needs are being addressed at school? You feel as though you can talk to an adult about your mental health and something will be done about it?
Besides the relationship building that I've done on my own personally, within the school, it's almost very difficult to take the time to, you know, ask for help or to get the help you need so you can perform the best as you can. Unfortunately, these resources that are just like broadcasted and told to us aren't as accessible as it may seem. In a school building, even if you just walk a random day in the school building, you see so much going on. There's always so much going on and so much that needs to be dealt with, things that are just conflict-based, things that are just like so much. And it's like, as a student, where do I fit in? How can I have the room? If I'm trying to go to talk to the counselor about me having a bad night and, you know, they're having difficulties with scheduling and this and third and all this put onto their plate, how are they ever going to have conversations with me? And I know there's so much that's been implemented, and honestly, we're moving in the right direction. But the question is, like, are we moving quick enough? Like, these mental health issues are on the rise. Like, everybody knows that this is worldwide. Mm-hmm. People are experiencing extreme mental health issues. And if we're moving step by step, getting one program slowly, it's not going to have as big as an impact as it needs to, because we have at least 50% of the school experiencing very difficult conditions, both in school and outside of school.
Shannon, how do you feel about it?
I feel like mental health isn't really talked about in school, honestly. Like, I feel like people know about it, but it's no awareness in it in school. And like, kind of what Rahema said, it's like, you can't really go to nobody in school about, you know, mental health, because someone's always busy about it. I mean, someone's always busy, like, with something else. Like, my counselor, I was trying to talk to my counselor, but I only talked to her one time because she's just so busy, you know, with scheduling and stuff like that. So I don't really do nothing about mental health in school.
So what's the solution?
Yeah, I think we hear a call for more mental health professionals, and that's part of the solution. Mm-hmm. I think there needs to be a broader understanding of mental health, and that everybody doesn't need to be a trained mental health professional to help support mental, emotional, and behavioral health, right? So a lot of us are trained in things like mental health first aid and trauma-informed care. You know, a lot of times I'm going into schools and family meetings, and again, it's just helping the administrators and maybe the student support team know about some of the things that are going on. Because most of the time when we talk to our youth and when we start working with some of the youth that we have in our program, they don't trust us initially. They generally don't trust adults for good reason, because we don't understand them and we don't listen to them, and they're dealing with a very different world. And so for us to humble ourselves, I hear adults talking to students a lot of the time, kind of preaching to them or telling them what to do. And a lot of the advice is actually not relevant, because it's a totally different environment and generation. And mm-hmm. So I think we as adults need to humble ourselves a little bit and understand there's generational differences and learn from our students. I feel really lucky to have built relationships with these students and others, and for them to teach me about how to better work with them, right? And so I can build a relationship of trust, and I can come in sometimes, or Ed or Danielle or others can come in, and we can help build that shared understanding and say to an administrator or you know, the student support team, how can we work together? Because you're going to have to partner to some degree with family and community. And we hear a lot of times about parents not caring, but parents are extremely overwhelmed. You know, there's studies that have come out in terms of the high rate of parental stress. The Surgeon General just issued an advisory last week about the high degree of parental stress and it being a public health epidemic, right? And so we're doing our best to kind of to triage this stuff and to put a plan together. But I've had so much success just going in and putting things like a safety plan in place for a student or a check in, check out. I say to students all the time that are struggling, who's one safe adult in the building? Who's one teacher that you like and can trust? And can I help you? Can we facilitate this so that we can set up a plan so that somebody has eyes on you? Because like Rahama said, it's crazy someday in the schools and the adults are also stressed and overwhelmed. So if we don't have some level of intervention, if it can't be the parent or the parent needs help, we need to have some community supports and we need to have some advocates to make sure that those students know that they do have safe people and adults that they can go to.
I want to quickly get to transportation. There are still issues with both yellow buses and I think we discussed the NFTA buses. What else is going on?
First, we agreed to have the transportation committee meet indefinitely, and we met zero times last year. So I've been assured that we would meet this year. So we can. This is a problem that we'll have for eternity, because we haven't figured out how to make bus drivers full-time employees with health benefits, so that they want to keep their job. Right. So we need to have a committee talking about it monthly. So the three bell time wasn't popular,
right?
But it did get many kids to school that weren't getting to school. The problem is now they're not getting home at a timely manner. So we solved one problem by causing another problem. And that was the battle that we had, because we can't mysteriously find all these bus drivers that we had just 4 years ago. So that's always going to be a battle. And we have to meet monthly as a community, not just me and David Hills, but, you know, people from the community, students, principals, everybody needs to come to the table so we can talk about this and, you know, make sure our kids are safe, they get to school on time and get home in a timely fashion. Because if they don't get home in a timely fashion, they're going to mysteriously be sick and not want to go to school. And it's a battle for us in the morning, parents, when our kids, especially our kids with disabilities, like they are set on a time schedule. Mm-hmm. If my son came home 20 minutes late, he would be upset for the rest of the night. So it's important that we can work on this problem continuously.
I agree. And that is something that we're pushing for, because yes, we did get the data from David. He announced last year that the three bell improved things, but we know that we need more drivers. We, you know, a couple transportation forums, we had a lot of bus drivers there just saying like, this is the reality. Like we are working tirelessly to get these kids, and they love our kids. They love being able to transfer them, you know, to and from school, but they also shouldn't be working till all hours of the night and, you know, working a lot of overtime. Like we've got to get it figured out. So yeah, I agree. We have to meet regularly. So
we love our drivers too, and our aides, and they're important. Yes. You know, they're part of our family. They for 180 days out of the year, we're entrusting them to take our children to and from school. It's important. We care about them. We want what's best for them. So we want more drivers so they're not overworked.
After all of that, in what areas are you seeing progress in the district?
Well, go ahead, Rama.
I can speak to that personally. I think over the past summer and like towards the end of the school year, we did create a relationship with Ruth Connor. And it was nice getting to learn from her, getting to understand real life experiences that she's going through and all the efforts that she's making. And I just think that just calls attention to the importance of relationship building. I'm not gonna lie, I was one of those students complaining about the school food, saying all the school food, all these, you know, things about the school food. But now that I feel like I've had more of an understanding, I can speak more more with an understanding of all bases and different aspects. And I think that's just like one thing that's going good. And it's like, moving forward, if we keep having students building relationships with people who are in higher position or more authoritative positions, it might just create a better community and environment and culture for people well-being to be prioritized.
Yeah, and I was just to that point, we do have a lot of people in the district that will sit down with us. You know, the superintendent sits down with Parent Congress, and she is always willing to listen. So that's great. Like, not everybody gets that. And we've amplified student voice, and we've made a put a focus on it so that when we're going to these district meetings, we're pushing for more students to be involved and not just, you know, the student council, but everybody's. We need everyone at the table. And I think that's something that's changing in the district. They're willing to, you know, bring in more voices and hear from the affected youth to work together to make change. So I think that that's a huge positive and a step in the right direction.
I think one of the most positive things, even though we don't always get the results we want, the superintendent's open to talking to us. Our past superintendent wouldn't even have a meeting with us. So Dr. Williams Knight, she has allowed us to come to the table. We're not always happy with the progress, but we meet, and she doesn't avoid us. She doesn't hide from us. We do talk about it. We do disagree sometimes, both ways. But we are communicating, and we are trying to work on our complicated issues. I mean, it's not simple, so we have to give credit. At least she's meeting with us, which is a huge step over the last superintendent. But we feel like the progress is really slow.
Any good things that you're seeing, Shannon?
Well, in school, in my lunchroom, in the beginning of your school year, we didn't have no salad bar. We didn't have a salad bar. And, you know, towards the, like, couple months before school ended, we got it back for the rest of the school year. So I'm happy about that.
And that was really in large part due to, again, student voice. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what I'm really encouraged about. I've been doing this work for a while. My kids are, one of my children has graduated at this point out of BPS. I still have one that's in high school. But just having done this work for a period of time and seeing how powerful the youth can be to make change. We're obviously working on the parent side, and that's important too. But the youth were the ones that were advocating for that, right? They were saying the salad bars are not in our school. We did have David Hills, the chief operating officer, who came and sat with us. And we've had circles with the youth, with the superintendent, with the board president, with the food service director, with the chief operating officer. People will come and meet with us. And when they can come and actually sit in circle, and we do that in an authentic way because we are practitioners. And mm-hmm. we do know how to, we have a diverse group of students who come from really different backgrounds and experiences. And we're not just pulling them out of a school and asking them for their opinion. We invest in them intentionally. You know, these students go through training. They've gone through additional training with restorative practices and trauma-informed care and things like that. So they know how to give language to some of these things, to advocate for themselves, and they can have a meaningful conversation, right? We educate them about where power is and how to go to a board meeting and speak there. And so I think that's encouraging when we can bring people together, and I think that there is an openness to doing so. And there has been lots of problems that have been solved. And a lot of the time, it's district folks who are coming and sitting with our students or listening to our students and their direct lived experience and doing their best to problem solve and come up with solutions.
Last question. I'm going to go around. How are you approaching this school year? Ed, I'm going to start with you.
I'm going to take the same approach I have every year. I'm going to answer every phone call like it's the most important phone call in the world and support that family the best I can. If not, I'll reach out to my parent leaders, Jessica, Danielle, Maylena, and other ones, and get to support the families' need because they're our future.
Danielle? Yeah,
I think going into the school year, I always go in optimistic. I think we can have a great year. I think we've made some progress that we're going to build on. And I think just the new leadership in Parent Congress, bringing more parents to the table and, you know, working together with family engagement to bring more parents into the fold. Like, that's really what we want to focus on. We're amplifying the student voice, bringing more students into the conversation, and we need more parents too.
Jessica?
Yeah, I would echo what Ed and Danielle have said. You know, this work sometimes is long haul work. So we have to sometimes think about the legacy that we're going to leave because people age out of this work eventually, right? Your kids get older. These students mm-hmm. will graduate, and we've been through cycles of that. And so I'm really being intentional now as I'm, you know, getting into my last couple of years on the parent side here of making sure that, you know, we can leave a legacy here and that there's capacity so that this work is not just dependent on me or people that are here right now, right? Who are the parents that are coming in? It's great that we've been able to establish a parent congress that's recognized parent groups, right? So that there's some degree of parent power and efficacy. And same thing with the students. You know, I just see so much potential when we invest in some students. And a lot of the students that come to us because they've been suspended or they're having an issue. We are specifically recruiting students who may have a voice and may need some help directing it in inappropriate ways. And we've just seen some really incredible things with many of the young people that we're working with.
I feel like I'm going to approach the school with an open mind, like take it more seriously, you know, ready for, you know, the work. I'm planning on studying more too, so.
As I like enter my senior year, I'm definitely, you know, thinking of a lot as, you know, entering a new chapter in my life, I guess. So there's that, like on the academic side, but I'm really glad that I have the resources and like the people here. And I think it's so important to like spread the word to other students as well, because I feel like personally, like if you were to ask me 2 years ago, like, oh, how would I feel about going into the school year? I would tell you like, I'm so frustrated. I don't want to go to school. Like I love summer and this is like the worst time of my life. But now it's like, I have people that I can talk to, and if I do experience a conflict, I have people outside of school that I know are willing to go to bat for me and to help me to navigate what I experience every day.
Make no mistake about it, but this conversation is going to continue throughout the school year. So I want to thank my guests, Jessica Bauer Walker, Danielle Grismala, Ed Spidell, Rahema Kashindi, and Shannon Morgan for being with us today. This is WBFO News in Buffalo, Toronto Public Media.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.